Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hey there again, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Money Tree Investing Podcast. I'm Joe Salcihi from Stacking Benjamins. And man, do we have a great show for you today. As promised, Andrew Channon is the CEO of Pure Funds, and he has a topic that we said we were going to talk about, silver. One of his two funds is ticker symbol SILJ, the Pure Funds ISE Junior Silver ETF. It was created to bring silver exploration and mining exposure of small cap companies to institutional and retail investors alike. These companies are all looking for the next big silver deposit, can benefit from the discovery of a new deposit, production of metal-rich mines, that's better, or becoming a takeover target. SILJ is the first pure play ETF to exclusively hold silver explorers and junior silver producers. So how is silver different than the commodities we talked about a couple weeks ago? And should you parse silver from different commodities or from different metals? Well, we'll talk to Andrew and then we'll talk to our roundtable. But first, a word from our sponsors.
Trading involves risk of loss and is not appropriate for everyone.
We've never met, but I know a secret about you, something your own mother doesn't know. I know the number one profit-killing mistake you're currently making with your trading. Hi, I'm Bill Polis, and I created an unusual 15-second quiz that can pinpoint and eliminate your number one mistake so you can potentially risk as little as $25 to make $100. Find out how at MoneyQuiz101.com. For the next few days, it's free. Just go to MoneyQuiz101.com. That's MoneyQuiz101.com.
And Andrew Channon, CEO of Pure Funds, ISE Junior Silver ETF joins us. Welcome, man.
Thanks so much for having me. Thrilled to be here.
Well, it's great to talk to you because, and I have to say, the timing is good because since March 1st, you're beating both the Dow and gold. And since March 10th, you've been on this monster tear up from $7 to where you are now. What's going on?
Sure. So precious metals have been an investment that for the last 5 years have caused a lot of people to rethink its placement in their portfolios. And for most of those people, rethinking meant just get rid of it. Don't put it in the portfolio. Commodities can be risky, and you know, bonds and stocks on a broad base have been performing pretty darn well since that same time that the metals have been selling off. And I think there was just so much fear regarding precious metals, and specifically silver, even more so than gold, that we'd seen such a large sell-off that so many people just said, you know, forget about it. I'm not interested in this. It's too speculative. And now we're getting to this point where we're seeing a lot of the primary silver miners are actually not able to produce metal cheaper than the actual spot price. So we're seeing a lot of the primary miners that focus only on silver that they're having a tough time being profitable in this environment. And so we've seen a lot of selling off of assets and spinoffs and just people, companies trying to wipe their balance sheet clean of this. And I think now we're starting to see the people with cash that know the industry starting to look at this as a very opportunistic time to start buying, while compared to other asset classes, silver is looking very, very inexpensive right now. So I think many people have been looking for a big capitulation where we see a complete washout in the price. But instead, we've seen very, very strong support for silver in the $15 range. And I think that's what's bringing a lot more eyes back to silver.
You mentioned silver, but maybe more than other precious metals. Why is that? Is it exactly what you were just talking about the fact that they can't make any profit because of the price of the metal? Is that the reason why silver specifically versus, let's say, gold or platinum or something else?
I think that's why the miners, why we've seen a bump in them recently, because more firming up, I think, of the silver price. But typically, silver trades with a higher beta than gold. So it's typically more volatile, but they might move in the same direction. So when gold rallies, it's not atypical to see silver rally more. And vice versa, when gold's selling off, it's common for silver to sell off more. So when you start seeing a change in sentiment for the metals, it's not surprising that if gold's going up, that silver can make that move a lot faster. So being in the junior silver space specifically, these junior companies, these exploration companies, typically trade at a higher beta than their senior producer, larger counterparts. And typically the miners and explorers themselves trade at a higher beta than the metal themselves. So in an event that we do see a bottoming in precious metals prices, a lot of times many experienced traders will say the miners tend to lead the metal itself. So that can be a good indicator for a potential change in sentiment for the actual metals as well as the miners by watching the miners.
I was going to ask about correlation since you brought up beta. But when it comes to correlation, is there a negative correlation between silver and stocks or closer to no correlation between silver and, let's say, Dow Jones Industrial Average stock?
I think it depends really on the cycle that we're in. Precious metals, when you look at them, and you're in a strong dollar economy, it could look pretty bearish. You know, lots of times people will look at the dollar to compare precious metals prices to see strength, relative strength, and things like that.
Yeah.
But when you look at it in dollar terms, you're missing what the metal's doing in foreign currency terms. So if you look at something like the Canadian dollar, which has been doing very poorly versus the US dollar, you'll see that in Canadian dollars that the metal price is actually significantly stronger year to date than what we've seen here. So it's a complete kind of different, it's more of a global commodity than trying to compare it to smaller or US-based types of investments. But I think to look at it, it can be a good indicator of inflationary times. And I think that a lot of people are looking at the metals to be potentially an indicator for the next cycle. And we've seen right now that since, let's call it April 2011, the precious metals have been pretty much in a downward trend.
Right.
And at the same time, now we're seeing that many of the broad-based stock indexes are trading at all-time highs. And we're even seeing negative yield in some debt issuances. And I think that's where we're going to see the next change. And maybe precious metals will be the one that will say, hey, you know, maybe stocks are overvalued here, or maybe there should be more yield on fixed income investments.
You know, let's do this. Let's parse out silver from gold, because you and I have talked before, and I love talking to you because a lot of, let's say, newbie investors or even just the average mom and pop investor, they think precious metals equals gold equals all precious metals, right? But you don't see it that way. That all metals really are a little different.
I'm glad you brought that up. And when people look at gold, gold typically, when it gets mined, it gets converted into bars, coins, or jewelry, essentially. And when you look at silver, it's so much more complex, and it's such an integral piece of not only the precious metals community, but also the industrial community. And most people aren't familiar, but about 60% of all silver mined annually actually goes into industrial purposes. So people might think precious metals, they think gold, silver, platinum, palladium, but silver is even more important as an industrial metal than as a precious metal, at least currently. Back 100 years ago, silver was significantly important as the monetary metal, and that hasn't been the case anytime recently. But I think that that has the potential to make silver such an important metal going forward, because not only does it have the precious metals qualities, as a metal itself, silver is the best conductor of all metals of heat. It's the best conductor of all metals of electricity. It's one of the most reflective substances on the planet. And it also has antibacterial, antimicrobial properties to it, which is huge already in the medical world. And, you know, just because of these incredible properties that are intrinsic to the metal itself, you know, increased technological advances using silver going forward would not be a surprise. So I think right now, what's so interesting about silver is that there's all these incredible uses, and there's so many patents out there for more potential future uses for silver. And we haven't really experienced a major supply issue. But right now, where we're seeing many of the silver miners shutting down mines or canceling future exploration opportunities, I think that we're setting up with this low silver price to start seeing increase in demand for silver and a decrease in that actual supply. I think when we do see that happen, there'll be a dramatic effect, and one that could cause silver prices to do things that many people don't expect, given that it's so important already on an industrial level, that if it became an even more important investment metal, monetary metal, something like that going forward, that outcome, I don't think many, if any, people are even considering that.
Yeah, I love just listening to you talk about that because I think about all the technological, easy for me to say, technological advances that are out there. And I'm with you. I had never thought of that until you had brought that up before. And I know being a silver guy, you might be a little biased. So this might be a question, Andrew, about like asking the home team when investors should pick the away team. But is there ever a time when gold would be a smarter play than silver?
Sure. And, you know, I think that I don't dislike gold. I personally think that given the circumstances right now that I personally like silver more than gold as things stand now. I think one important indicator to look at is the gold-silver ratio. And that's essentially how many ounces of silver it would cost to buy 1 ounce of gold. Mm. And we've seen that number anywhere from it costing 10 ounces of silver to buy 1 ounce of gold to being near the 80 range. So I think I would look at that indicator to say, okay, is silver cheap relative to gold or is it expensive relative to gold? And I might be on the outskirts, but I wouldn't be surprised if at some point in our lifetimes we saw, you know, a 20-to-1 ratio. And so I kind of look at that as a way to figure out which one seems more expensive than the other. And there could be a time that I want to completely shift my stance and go, you know, out of silver and into gold if we reached another extreme. But right now, we've seen silver very undervalued relative to gold. And the way that I'll kind of give those numbers is if you look at different geological surveys out there, you'll see that silver is about 14 to 16 times as abundant in nature as gold is. Now, if you look at any of the recent supply numbers that come in for the last couple of years, we've only been mining about 8 or 9 ounces of silver in every ounce of gold mined. So right now, so you look at, you know, that 14-16-to-1 ratio, yet it's only coming out at an 8 or 9-to-1 ratio. And then 60% of all silver being mined is going straight into industrial purposes. So not even the precious metal jewelry like gold is, although it is going into there as well, but not, you know, predominantly into there. So you look at these different numbers, and then when you see our gold-silver ratio, you know, in the 50-60s, I don't think that accurately prices how valuable silver is compared to gold, given that it is this indispensable industrial metal. So I think if we saw the ratio approach closer to 20-to-1, then maybe that's when I would start to shift back towards gold. But right now, I think relatively speaking, silver is cheap compared to gold.
I want to ask you about the basics of your exchange-traded fund, because I'll bet most investors, you know, more and more people are using exchange-traded funds, but they don't have any idea, Andrew, about how an exchange-traded fund is even made. How many stocks are in your ETF?
We try to keep it roughly in the mid-20 range right now. So it's companies from around the globe currently in this fund. I believe it's about 75% Canadian-listed companies, with the remainder being U.S.-listed and U.K.-listed. But the very neat thing that I think about the composition is those countries don't necessarily give you, my saying that it's listed in a country doesn't necessarily give you the actual geographical diversification that is actually inherent to these companies. Because although many precious metals or natural resource companies may be listed in Canada, such as the case with SILJ, our fund, many of these companies have properties abroad. So it's not uncommon, it's actually very common to see a Canadian listed company with all their properties in Mexico and you know, just the headquarters in Canada. So although you might see that doesn't look like it's very geographically diverse, within the fund, there's companies with either current properties or producing mines possibly in Canada, the US, Mexico, Peru, Colombia, Argentina, Australia, China, you know, where there's silver prevalent in the world, these companies, despite being listed in one exchange, could have properties in many of these silver-rich countries from around the world.
How do they get picked, these companies? Because I know that it's miners, it's small cap, and it seems like it'd be difficult to figure out who exactly that space is. And I'm sure there's got to be a methodology. It's not just you threw a dart and hit 25 different companies. So I'm pretty sure you and Chris Monaco over at ISE, you guys do a little bit more thorough job than that.
Sure. So the selection process is exactly like you said, the International Securities Exchange.
Okay.
They have a very strong background in creating equity-based indexes. They've worked with other issuers in the past to create natural resource equity related indexes, and this is just another one of theirs. So one of the things that they look at, which I think is probably one of the most important parts for inclusion within an ETF, is looking at the liquidity. And they want to make sure that the company trades a fairly decent amount, typically over $1 million of daily value traded for specific symbols. And the reason behind that is if there's a large inflow into the fund of new investors, that you're not completely moving the underlying market. So that's from a liquidity stance, how they do it. But what they're looking for specific companies, what they're looking for is, if they are producing, they're looking for companies that have a high percentage of their revenues coming from the production of silver. Or if they're in the exploration phase or somewhere in between that and bringing a mine into production, they're looking at potential percentage of revenues from silver. So one of the main points that we want to stress with this fund is that we try to give investors as pure play of an exposure as we can get them in a specific industry. And with precious metals mining, it's very typical that you'll have byproducts. So even if you're a primary silver mine, there's a good chance that you're also mining other metals that maybe you're selling off as a byproduct. But many of the companies in the fund are producing, have a high percentage of their revenues derived from silver. So even if they are maybe potentially a primary zinc producer or nickel or something like that, they're also producing a high percentage of silver. So it's probably more difficult in the mining space than in other type of sub-industry ETF creations to build that. But the ISE screened, you know, the entire publicly traded investable universe and wound it down to what they thought were some of the most pure play junior and exploration types of silver plays out there.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about your other ETF at Pure Funds, and that's your cybersecurity fund. I love that ticker symbol, Andrew, HACK. That's phenomenal.
Much appreciated. We've been very proud of that fund. We launched it back in November of 2014. So we've been out for, let's call it 6.5 months or so. We've already raised over $750 million under management. Not only have we been excited, but the investing community out there has expressed a lot of interest in the fund. And it's another area where we thought that it was perfect for an ETF, yet there hadn't been an ETF out there for it yet. And we were thrilled to be able to bring it out to the market first. And we're happy to get the word out. It's just such a growing industry that people are not that familiar with it. But I think it's becoming something that everyone agrees is an extremely important, integral part of our modern world that we live in. And the more connected individuals, companies, networks become, the more important that cybersecurity, cyber defense is built into personal, government, and corporate lives.
I don't understand what you're saying. Are you saying that people are actually worried about hackers? Is that what you're saying? Because I hadn't heard that before.
At first, they were just worried about their nude pictures getting circulated. Right. And now they're worried about their health information getting circulated, yeah, or their emails that they're sending around at their company. So it's putting people on edge and seeing the actual real effects of cyber breaches and, you know, these increasing costs, the increasing amount of information that's getting breached. All of these is making, I think, a front page concern. And we've seen since we've launched the Sony attack and the Anthem attack, and just yesterday, the Japanese pensions. People don't know where the next attack is going to be. But the one consensus is that you have to do something on the cybersecurity front. And so far, spending money has been one of the best solutions out there.
Yeah, the frustrating thing is when you see these healthcare companies, I mean, hackers are smart. They're looking at companies that haven't yet spent the money, right? So they're able to get tons of information on companies that thought that hackers wouldn't look at them.
And recently, I think we saw a lot of hackers look for the golden goose of potential threats, and they would be going after the largest corporations out there. Yeah. And now I think they're starting to see that because these companies are taking their cybersecurity a lot more seriously, it can be harder for them to breach, where they're realizing that there's still some significant opportunity in, you know, companies a tier below in size. And they might not have, you know, got the memo that they're next on the list. And I think we're seeing a shift as well into some of the more medium-sized companies. So, you know, once we see the next wave of that come through, I don't think anyone can have an excuse of, oh, I didn't think it could happen to me.
So that's two funds that you have, Andrew. Any other new funds on the horizon?
We have filed, but I can't go into details, but we're looking to carve out a space in the technology ETFs spot for pure funds.
Oh, come on, Andrew. It's just you, me, and 5,000 listeners. Come on.
I wish I could say more, but I look forward to joining you on another podcast and giving you that information when I can.
Well, that's a deal. So back to the ISE Junior Silver ETF. How do people buy it?
Sure. So through most brokers, your Fidelity, your E-Trade, what have you, I'd call your financial advisor and ask them that and read through the prospectus so you're more familiar with it. But it's available on most major brokerage accounts.
I want to ask you one last question on silver. You know, you do these interviews all the time. I've seen you on the major financial networks before giving interviews like this one. If you have heard one misconception about silver in the past that you just love to dispel, right? It's just like that nails on a chalkboard. What would that be?
Gosh, there are so many. But I think, one of the things out there, some people, maybe the number is not zero, but, some people think that silver is going towards zero. And it's an asset class. It's a real asset. It's a commodity. It's something that for thousands of years was used as money. Right now, we use paper currency backed by full faith and trust. But precious metals for thousands of years have been important. From anyone that's alive today, their ancestors cared about precious metals. And the fact that people don't really consider it as an asset, I think the further the price goes down, the less risk that is there. And, to see that so many people abhor it right now, makes me so interested in it. And the ability to go on programs like yours and to be able to talk about the positives for silver and why it's so important and that these misconceptions are causing it to become even more undervalued. It's bothersome to hear, but it's great to be able to have the opportunity because you know that there are other people out there that don't necessarily have the full picture.
Trading involves risk of loss and is not appropriate for everyone.
We've never met, but I know a secret about you. Something your own mother doesn't know. I know the number one profit-killing mistake you're currently making with your trading. Hi, I'm Bill Polis, and I created an unusual 15-second quiz that can pinpoint and eliminate your number one mistake so you can potentially risk as little as $25 to make $100. Find out how at MoneyQuiz101.com. For the next few days, it's free. Just go to MoneyQuiz101.com. That's MoneyQuiz101.com.
Well, welcome to the second half of our show, our exciting roundtable segment. Let's see if I can slaughter everybody's names this week like I did last week. We'll start off with Andrea Trevelyan at Take a Smart Step. Is that better?
Ooh, you got it right. Good job.
I've only known you how long? I mean, pronouncing your name right is...
That's all right.
So you've had some...
I don't get it right.
You've had some fun with electronics this week.
Yeah, you could say that. It makes you really, truly just want to go away. So what Joe's talking about is with all the storms in Dallas, we had a giant power surge during one of the really bad ones. And it knocked out TV, cable, internet, garage door, one of the air conditioning units, you name it. So revolving door service guys coming in and out makes it hard to work.
Oh, yeah, that's
anything done.
It's hard to have a job, isn't it?
Damn job. Yeah,
keeps getting in the way of fixing your electronics.
Although I will say from Thursday to Monday, we had no internet, and that was interesting.
Oh, life without internet. What is it like?
Life without internet or TV. Like, we still don't even have TV.
Yeah.
So, stared at each other.
No. Is that when you find what your marriage is really made of?
We were actually out of town at a wedding, so it was really good timing for the wedding.
Yeah, it would be. I was going to say, no internet. It's like it's 1987.
It was so weird. I don't know what I would have done without my iPhone. Because it was really weird.
Yeah, Andrea can't watch your cat videos. But let's introduce the other two players on this show. The guy who's the power surge on this podcast. How's that for a transition? Andrew Sather from eInvesting for Beginners.
Hey, you got my name right this time. I guess all your brain cells are firing A-plus right now. Good job, Joe.
You have no idea how little my brain cells are actually firing this morning. But you just woke up a little bit ago.
Yeah, 5-10 minutes ago. It was tough to crawl out of bed. I don't know what's going on.
Well, anytime you get to crawl out of bed and talk silver with us, isn't that a great way to start your day?
I do feel better now, yeah.
And the person who's the silver and gold on our podcast, Miranda Marquit from Planting Money Seeds.
Cheesy book in front of you today.
I am on fire. How are you, Miranda?
I'm okay.
Somebody told me on Stacking Benjamins, they gave me a review that said that I am far more upbeat on Stacking Benjamins than I am on Planting Money Seeds. So I'm trying to rectify that. I'm trying to get it moving.
You're on Planting Money Seeds? When did this happen?
Or not on Planting Money Seeds. What podcast are we on?
The Money Tree Podcast.
I'm a Money Tree. No, Miranda.
My site is planting money seeds.
I know. So
welcome to.
I'm taking over your site.
Oh my gosh.
Well, let's talk about Andrew Channon and about silver, because I found that to be a really interesting conversation. And let's talk to our panel here. Andrea, how much higher return do you get, you know, between parsing silver and gold like he talked about? Do you think it's worth the time to say, I'm going to be in silver versus gold, or do you just go all precious metals?
Well, you know me, I'm not going either. But
if I did,
you know, I think it all comes back to market timing. So we talk about market timing with stocks and bonds and everything else. I think it's the exact same thing here. So it's kind of like throwing darts in the dark. Who knows?
I had never thought about that, Andrew, about the fact that when Andrew Channon was talking about that this might be a better time for silver, and that's why the surge has been happening just lately here in Surger versus gold or the Dow, that parsing these might be fortuitous.
Well, I think it really comes down to what Andrew said in the interview, and there's this really important ratio of silver to gold. And so there's been times where gold will become extremely overvalued, and you'll see that ratio skyrocket. And then it's at those times when either gold is overvalued or silver is overvalued that can make one or the other a better investment, depending on, A, if you're even trying to do precious metals, which that's kind of been an ongoing discussion we've been having, and we all have different opinions on that. And B, if silver or gold is overvalued relative to each other, because they both do a good job at kind of keeping the currency honest. And so if you look at the relation of the value of silver or gold to different currencies, and you also look at the relation of silver and gold to itself. And so, like Andrea said, it really comes down to timing. There are times when silver is a better play than gold. There are times when gold's a better play than silver. And there are times when neither of them are good plays. And if it's something that you want to add to your portfolio, those are definitely things that you need to find out for yourself.
Do you follow that ratio?
I do not know. I've heard horror stories about silver. I had a reader actually message me on Facebook about a year ago talking about how she had used student loans to buy silver coins when silver was in the $40 range. And then she messaged me last year and silver was like trading at $20 an ounce. So I've heard horror stories, and it's a bad example of timing that you don't really hear too often in the mainstream media.
Using student loans to buy silver coins. Miranda, what could go wrong with that?
So much. So here's the thing about silver, that if there's anything to like about any precious metal ever, which none of us really care for investing in these sorts of things, but if there's anything to like about silver, and if you're going to invest as kind of a hedge against inflation, and you're looking at the price of gold and saying, oh my gosh, that's so expensive. One nice thing about silver is that it's affordable. It's like the poor man's gold, right? If you're looking for precious metal investing. And that's pretty much what it's got going for it, right? Because you can afford it. But once again, you still have these issues with perceived value. You have these issues with market timing. And you have the fact that sometimes gold and silver have this sort of strange relationship with each other in terms of pricing. So it's really hard to pin it down.
I was just thinking as you're talking, but silver, you know, when he was talking about the fact that silver has some uses, it seems to me that silver then should be, theoretically, should be a little more predictable.
You would think that, but it's probably just as predictable as any other investment, you know, just as predictable as the stock market, just as predictable as oil prices. You can look at these trends and look for indications that something might be happening or that something is going to change or that there's these fundamental ideas. But ultimately, what it comes down to is you can't predict everything and there's just no way to know.
You know, he talked about this idea of economic cycles and about where silver fits in different economic cycles. And I'm wondering from all of you, how economic cycles play into your investing decisions? Do you look longer and beyond those, or do you pay attention to where we're at in an economic cycle? Let's start, Andrea, with you.
I would not put an economic cycle as kind of one of my top five, but I definitely take it into consideration. Like, for example, right now, I kind of think we're at a little bit of a peak. So I might pick very different stocks, but I'm still looking at like fundamentals and growth and management first. So I guess kind of looking at economics with precious metals, I don't know if I would use that as kind of a guideline. You know, there's things like we had talked about super cycles, but I always get the feeling that there is no rhyme or reason with metals. So I don't know if I would follow the economy.
But when it comes to economic cycles, you said that it's not in your top five, but you do look at it. You think we're at a peak. What type of stocks would you buy or would you be focusing on in this particular economy?
A lot more defensive, the ones that are going to hold up in a downturn. So we've talked about kind of your SETI aren't going anywhere anytime soon. So Johnson & Johnson, Procter & Gamble, kind of the ones that when we do hit a rough patch, people are still buying laundry detergent, people are still buying food, that type of thing. Versus your like Coach and maybe a Macy's, you know, kind of your spending type stocks is what I would call them.
Yeah, let's ask the value guy, because it seems like for you, I would think, Andrew, that economic cycles play a big part in your investing strategy.
Actually, believe it or not, they don't. You want to focus on the things that you can control and not worry about the things you can't control. So while it's good to have a general understanding of what the economy is doing, really the things that you can best control as a value investor is what price you are paying for a stock. So that means buying stocks that are undervalued. And the second thing is, what's the financial condition of the company that you're buying? So you want to buy stocks that are in a strong financial condition. They have good assets, low debt. I mean, especially low debt, because in a time of contraction, when the market tanks, the biggest stocks that crash are going to be the ones that have really high valuations and the ones that have really high amounts of leverage on their balance sheet. So if you can stay away from those, you can just by nature limit your downside exposure if things go downhill.
Yeah. Miranda, do economic cycles play a part in the way that you pick investments and pick your ETFs?
Let's repeat all together now. Indexing.
You could pick different indexes. Like what Andrea is saying is that maybe...
I'm an all market person. I'm an all market person. I'm like, if I'm not doing an all market or an all world, it's maybe the S&P 500. So it really doesn't, other than looking at it and going, oh, hey, the market's crashing, I think I'll buy some more shares of these index funds. There's really not a whole lot that the economic cycles help me with. But thinking of economic cycles, one of the things is, you know, when I was talking a little bit about unpredictability a little bit before, one of the things to remember is in the past, gold and the US dollar have moved inversely to each other quite a bit. But during just immediately after the last global financial crisis, gold and the US dollar both started gaining at the same time and moving together. And they were moving the same direction together. And so even though you could say, oh, well, let's look at this economic cycle and let's try and guess on this economic cycle, even if you look back and say, oh, well, it's always happened before this way, things went different this last time. And so how are you going to do that if it changes?
So just don't play the game.
Right. Yeah. So look for, you know, like what Andrew's talking about, value. Andrea's talking about, you know, fundamental analysis, looking at management and growth and those kinds of things, and saying, if you're going to try and second guess it at all, I like Andrea's style where she looks at it and says, well, what are people still going to need in this economic downturn? People are still going to need toilet paper. So there we go.
I read a book recently, and I'm not going to come up with the name of it. I've been racking my brain. But this particular investor, a fantastic investor, was talking about the second domino. He was talking about most people see something happening in the economy, and they look at stocks that are the first domino, right? He looks at the second domino. Once that first domino lands, what's going to happen next? Because often the first domino, the professional traders are going to be the guys that the men and women that swoop in and make all that money before the average person has a shot. He said the way to make really good money is to look at this second thing that might happen. I found it interesting that Andrew Channon kind of talked about that when he talked about currencies, metals, and mining stocks as if they're interchangeable, as if you can arbitrage the situation by looking at the second domino. I would think of anybody on this panel, Andrea, you're the person that might have done that before, where you're looking at what's the second thing that this might affect, not the first.
Yeah, I do like to think as many steps ahead as I can. Right now, honestly, I'm not sure what that next step's going to be, because I think that there's a lot of factors that are brand new. So like preparing for a market drawback, you know, or about due for another recession, just kind of if you look at waves and stuff like that, because they're a natural part. But the new factor that my second domino that I'm trying to figure out what's going to happen with is student loan debt. Because it's astronomically higher than it's ever been.
Yeah, so what's going
to
happen?
And I don't know.
Yeah.
That's why I said I'm still trying to figure it out. That's the piece that I'm like, okay, how is this going to impact everything? Because it's the one debt you can't get rid of. It's not bankruptible.
Andrew, when you're buying value stocks, are you looking at currencies and are you looking at product versus the price of the company, that sort of thing?
Currencies, no. You look at the Forex market and you look at how currencies are traded and how much they swing from day to day. I mean, even from hour to hour, it's just impossible to wrap your head around. And I think it's impossible to predict. I think it makes more sense to focus on things that don't vary so much over time. So the value of the dollar can, within a year, the value of the dollar can fluctuate so greatly. Like we've seen even in the past year, the dollar has been so strong. Whoever predicted that, you know,
right.
People coming out of the woodworks saying that the dollar was doomed. And now it's very strong compared to a lot of currencies. It makes me want to go to Europe right now because I can finally get decent pounds and decent euros for my dollar, where in the past, those currencies were a lot stronger. So I don't see currencies as a reliable source of research. And you can look at things that are more reliable, things like what are the total assets that a company has on their balance sheet. Those things don't fluctuate widely from year to year. So you can quickly see that some companies are in better spots than others. I think there was a second part to your question. I can't remember it, but I hope I answered the first part.
Well, no, he also talked about, you know, the metal and the actual miners, right? These are mining stocks that are in the ETF, SILJ. But he looks at those as they're changeable also. Like there's arbitrage there.
Yeah. So I really like what he said in the interview about even when it comes to buying silver, you want to buy it when it's undervalued. I think that principle of buying things when they're undervalued, that will do very well for you. With that said, when it comes to mining stocks, a little bit of a different take than what you might think. I mean, I talked in episode 39, people can listen to that, MoneyTree podcast/39. I talked about how I really like buying stocks that deal with commodities because you can kind of get the best of both worlds. You can get a dividend that grows, but also get exposure to commodities. When it comes to mining stocks, the situation is a little bit different. So what a mining stock does that's different from any other company is a regular company will have assets, and from those assets they will create earnings. And so it's very easy for a company to grow their assets, and as a result the earnings will grow, and you see this sort of compounding. For a mining stock, they actually hold the reserves as their assets. So that, let's say they're mining silver, they'll have a certain amount of silver reserves in their assets. But once they sell that silver in order to make profits, their assets must come down because it's an asset in their balance sheet. And so what you see with a lot of these mining companies, they'll have years of really high assets, makes them look like a great value. But then in order to get a year of really high earnings, they need to sell off those assets. So it becomes really hard to compound that growth in the way that a normal company does. Plus, you have all the expenses that mining companies have to deal with. They have a lot of risks as well. You could be mining in a certain area and all of a sudden you're not getting as much return as you thought you would on a project. And so the mining sector, especially the past couple of years, has been absolutely horrific. There's been many bankruptcies. There's been a lot of hardship financially. And I think it's a big reason is because it's just hard to make money in mining. So I think buying low is a great strategy when it comes to mining stocks, but you really, really have to be careful because it's not your average stock.
Yeah. It's, I mean, like Andrew said, it's so low right now. And you just said it's washing people out.
So it might be a good time to get in, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Miranda, you going out and buying mining stocks now then?
No. For many other reasons.
Yeah, right. Well, let's start with you with a real question, though, which is this. They have, Pure Funds has a second ETF, the cybersecurity ETF, and I love the HACK, as I mentioned earlier, ticker symbol. But these new ETFs like cybersecurity, is this really indexing or is this taking advantage of the fact that a lot of people want to index and we're all looking for the next hot thing?
Yeah, I think it's more of that second thing you said, more of the fad. I think it's more of, well, let's put together this index of cybersecurity because everybody's really big on it. And so it's really kind of an interesting thing because with ETFs, because of the way they're built and they trade like stocks, you feel like you're trading this index. And the other thing you have to remember is you don't actually have ownership in these companies. An ETF isn't direct ownership. It's not the same thing as a mutual fund. Even though it trades like stocks and it looks a lot like a mutual fund, it is not the same thing as a mutual fund. So that's something to remember as well when you're trading ETFs. But yeah, I think the cybersecurity thing is really more of a fad. It's sort of like when you were looking at the ETFs that are like based around wind energy or alternative energy or ETFs based around other types of things that are popular for the moment. And if you look at some of those, they tend to lose value quickly once the moment has passed. I mean, that doesn't mean that cybersecurity ETFs, you know, they might do well in the future. Who knows? Nobody knows. Yeah. But I'd rather bet on the market as a whole than put my eggs into a sector basket.
Andrea, do you do sector investing? You talked earlier about not being sure sometimes. If you're not sure, but you think the second domino, like we were talking about earlier, might be headed away, will you just buy an entire sector instead of individual stock?
I actually do that. If I'm not overly familiar with an industry, but I think an industry is about ready to hit an upturn, I will do a sector. About 10 years ago, maybe, I knew healthcare was going to change with the boomers getting older. So I jumped into a healthcare sector and holy crikeys, that's like my best performing one. So I do, but I kind of, going back to the economy discussion, I use those sector funds if I think a segment of the economy is going to do very different than the other segments of the economy, or if they look undervalued. I don't use it for kind of speculating. I guess I'd call it that. Like that's what cybersecurity one, I would look at that as more of kind of like a speculating. I don't think the industry is big enough or there's enough stocks in this fund to make it worthwhile versus like some of your bigger ones will have 100 companies. So I do, but I think you have to be careful about why you're getting into it.
So if you're doing this, it'll be a part of your play portfolio, not your hull of your ship, I suppose.
Yeah, I would consider that kind of part of my active position and not necessarily my index portion because I don't really consider it an index. I'm just taking a play on the entire industry.
I would think, Andrew, being a value investor, that cybersecurity wouldn't fall into the realm of things that you pay a lot of attention to.
Well, actually, I have no idea. I mean, it comes down to the numbers and it comes down to what kind of valuations are these companies trading at. Taking a wild guess, when it comes to new technologies and new forces, usually those things won't trade at any sort of a discount. Usually there's a lot of growth priced in.
Right.
But I haven't taken a look at it. I think on the surface, it sounds really interesting. I mean, this issue of cybersecurity is only growing as we go into a more technological type of world. But as far as the individual ETF or the stocks inside it, I can't really comment because I haven't looked at it.
Well, thanks everybody for playing today. That was fun. We'll have links to both of these peer funds that Andrew Channon and his team at Peer Funds manage at moneytreepodcast.com. And please visit Andrea's site at takeasmartstep.com, Andrew's site, eInvestingForBeginners.com, Miranda's site, PlanningMoneySeeds.com, and my site, StackingBenjamins.com. And if you have a moment, a great way to say thank you to us and help us find new listeners is to rate our show. Wherever you listen, give us a ranking. We're not really sure how the iTunes ranking works. Nobody is, frankly, but what we do know is that every time somebody interfaces with iTunes, that we go up in the rankings. And lately, guys, we've been in the top 20. What's that all about?
We're so awesome.
Apparently, that's it. That's great.
It's all because of you, Joe, and your peppiness.
I think it's because of our listeners. Our listeners are awesome. How about that? So thanks a ton.
Someone's awesome.
Thanks a ton, and we'll see everybody next week.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.